Good morning. I will call this committee meeting for the House Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. Today's date is Thursday, March 12th, and a quorum is present. I'm going to read the safety notice first. To ensure everyone can view, hear, and understand today's proceedings, we ask for your cooperation in maintaining decorum and civility throughout this hearing. For the safety, security, and comfort of all attendees, please note the following guidelines. Signs are not permitted in the hearing room. Verbal outbursts, shouting, or disruptive behavior will not be tolerated. Applause or other audible demonstrations are not allowed. Standing or sitting in walkways and aisles is prohibited. If you require any accommodations, please speak to the sergeant staff wearing the gold ties. State troopers and House security personnel are present to ensure everyone's safety. Those providing testimony will be given specific time limits, which must be strictly observed. If you receive an entrance ticket, please retain it, as you may be required for it may be required for re-entry if you leave the hearing room. Failure to comply with these guidelines may result in the removal from the hearing room. Our goal is to conduct this hearing efficiently while ensuring everyone the opportunity to observe and participate appropriately. The next item of business is the approval of the minutes from March 10th. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes? Representative Steer, would you like to move the minutes?
So moved.
The minutes have been moved. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes are approved. The first bill on the agenda today is House File 3560. So we will have the folks that are going to be presenting that come to the testifiers table, please. And I will move that House File 3560 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. Okay. Leader Niska, welcome, and welcome to the testifiers. We have the bill before the committee. Go ahead with your testimony of the bill.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Scott, Co-Chair Liebling, and members of the committee. It's always great to be back in the Judiciary Committee. I appreciate the invitation and the opportunity to present House File 3560, which is a version of the Uniform Electronic Estate Planning Documents Act that's been modified to fit with Minnesota law. It follows up on legislation that Representative Feist was the chief author of that passed a couple years ago when I was on the Judiciary Committee. I remember us looking at that. That allowed for electronic signing of wills, and it extends a lot of laws that we have passed that recognize the need for electronic signatures on all kinds of legal documents that we have here. But there is a gap in the law in terms of making sure that those who would get an electronic estate planning document like a trust, a healthcare directive, or a power of attorney document would know that they should honor the electronic signature on those documents, and this bill just fills in that gap. It's a joint effort between the State Bar Association and Minnesota's Uniform Law Commissioners, and I have with me representatives from both organizations who can provide more detail about the proposal. So thank you for your consideration, and I urge member support.
Thank you, Leader Niska. Ms. Lowe, go ahead with your testimony, please.
Thank you. My name is Kim Lowe. I'm an attorney here in the Twin Cities, and I'm also one of Minnesota's Uniform Law Commissioners. Many of you have probably seen me over the years come up and speak with you. A little bit about this act. In 2022, this Uniform Electronic Signatures of Estate Planning Documents was approved by the Uniform Law Commission. It is an addition to the Electronic Wills Act that was approved a couple years prior and was enacted here in Minnesota in 2023. To date, this act has been enacted in six states. It's moving around. Like I said, it was originally approved in 2022. It has been enacted in North Dakota, Illinois, Missouri, Oklahoma, Colorado, and the state of Washington. And those votes were unanimous in all those states. It is sort of making its way around the country, and currently, while it's under consideration in this state, it's also being looked at by D.C., Kentucky, Pennsylvania, Utah. So it is making its way slowly around the country. And like Representative Niska said, we've been working with the State Bar Association to make sure that we get these acts in place here in Minnesota to help our citizens with these needs.
Oh, thank you for your testimony. Next, Cameron Kelly, please introduce yourself at the tape and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Cameron Kelly. I'm an attorney in Stillwater, Minnesota. I'm a member of the MSBA Probate and Trust Section Legislative Committee and here today on behalf of the MSBA. Like to say thank you to Representative Niska for carrying this bill. As was said, the Electronic Wills Act allows wills to be signed electronically, but it doesn't allow the other documents that we would sign in an estate plan to be signed electronically. Powers of attorney, healthcare directive, trusts, and other things that are defined in the bill. And a complete estate plan is going to include those things. I can have my client sign a will, but if I don't have them sign the power of attorney and healthcare directive, there's a good chance that they're going to run into trouble down the road if they become incapacitated, start to age, and need help from their children or other people. While nothing prohibits those documents from being signed electronically, there's also nothing that expressly authorizes it. In fact, if you look at the Electronic Transactions Act, it says this act doesn't apply to estate planning documents. And so the concern is always that our client is going to take a power of attorney to the bank or take a healthcare directive to the hospital and not have them recognize the document because it has an electronic signature on it, and that keeps us using wet signatures. What this bill does is it gives express authority for using an electronic signature, and that's important to Minnesotans because there are people who don't have access. So there are people who are homebound, there are people who are hospitalized, who can't get into a lawyer's office to sign these sorts of documents. And there are good lawyers out there that'll go to a hospital, but it isn't always easy and it isn't always quick enough. And so that's one. Another problem with access is people who live in rural areas. There are people in basically what we would refer to as a legal desert in Minnesota where you have to drive an hour or more in order to get to an attorney. And those people using an electronic signature could have access to legal help remotely and the signatures remotely using this act to sign the document. I want to talk just a little bit about fraud, and I'm happy to also answer any questions about it. This act is not doing anything that we aren't already doing in the state of Minnesota, and it was already brought up that we're doing this with the Electronic Wills Act. That we're allowed to sign electronically. We're not aware of any instances of fraud that has come from the Electronic Wills Act at this point. In fact, the concerns that are there, and I'm not saying that there's not concerns, because as lawyers we deal with these sorts of issues all the time with people who come in and someone claims that daughter forged mom's signature on paper. A lot of the same issues that are concerns with paper are probably going to be concerns with electronic documents. But in some instances, the electronic signature may even improve how this is handled. And I'll give an example. This act says that if a power of attorney already requires a notary, that the notary is still required. If a healthcare directive requires witnessing, the witnessing is still required. The power of attorney to notarize it online, you would probably have to jump through more stringent restrictions than you would in person. So for example, I've been through this process. You're showing a picture of a photo ID which is captured and retained. That's more than a lot of notaries are doing in paper situations. Also, there are identity proofing questions that are asked with notarization software, the types of things you see with the credit report, which of these vehicles have you owned in the past sort of questions. And so that process is retained electronically. And so in a case of like a power of attorney, it could actually be helpful. It could help to prove up that that document is valid. So also when a witness is required, the witness by statute is required to be in visual and hearing contact just as though they're present with the person. So you have to be able to see and hear them accurately while this is happening so that you can make the same observations or ask the same questions that you would ask in person. I just had a witness ask me yesterday, how do we know this person isn't being unduly influenced? I was at someone's house, and we had a good conversation about it. You need to be able to have those conversations and make those observations. The Act also puts emphasis on security procedures. It's a defined term in the Act. This will allow courts to scrutinize those procedures. Documents that follow those procedures will probably be getting less scrutiny than a document that doesn't follow security procedures. And what I mean by that is signing on Adobe Sign or DocuSign, where there's an audit trail that's attached to the document following the signature that shows when it was signed, who signed it, what order it was signed in, and that information is part of the document and available to the court. I'm happy to answer any questions, and thank you again for allowing us to be here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for bringing this bill. I'm happy to be a co-author. I actually had the exact situation that we're talking about happen last weekend. I went out to a friend of a friend's house because her mother is homebound. She has really significant physical disabilities, and she was not able to leave the house to get a power of attorney notarized. And so I went to her house, and I notarized the power of attorney documents. And I was actually going to ask you to talk about the notarization because I was thinking, like, how does this work? And then I remembered that you had already put it in the bill. So I think that's important. But I think this is really important. I mean, the fact that it's come up in my life in the last, like, week tells you that just a lot of people will benefit from this. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Feist. Representative Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Representative Niska, for bringing this. And I just wanted to comment that, you know, I kind of was going to ask for sort of some comfort on some of the issues, but Mr. Kelly covered it so well, you kind of answered all my questions. So, you know, naturally, and I wasn't on the committee when we did the Electronic Wills Act, which, you know, wills are very sensitive for all the reasons that you all spoke about. So, you know, I appreciate that you appear to, of course, you have covered all the bases here, because when the Uniform Laws Commission and the Bar Association are both here telling us that, you know, you've done all this work, it's usually a pretty good bet. But I appreciate hearing the details from Mr. Kelly about all the safeguards that are involved. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other member questions? All right, seeing none. Then I will renew my motion that House File 3560 be recommended to pass and place on the general register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. You are on your way to the GR. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Our next bill is House File 3295. Representative Gordon. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Scott.
And since you are not on the committee, I will move House File 3295 before the committee and recommend that it be re-referred to the Committee on Elections, Finance, and Government Operations. To your bill.
Thank you, Chair Scott. I appreciate that. Prior to serving in the legislature here, I was the mayor of Isanti, and when I was first elected as the mayor of Isanti, I wanted to be as transparent as possible with the public. We began live streaming council meetings on Facebook against the advice of our city attorney. He expressed concern that state statute didn't clearly define the ability of a public body to live broadcast through social media or how to address the comments section regarding data practices and the public comment portion of the meeting. HF 3295 would clear all that up and hopefully lead to more public bodies live broadcasting meetings, which in turn would lead to a more engaged and informed electorate. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Is there any member of the public that wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no one, we will move to member questions. Anyone? Wow. Oh, Representative Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. The bill is, this is a little bit of a confusing topic.
Oh, yeah.
And thanks for your explanation. But I just wonder if you or maybe even nonpartisan staff could just kind of walk through the bill, just so we all kind of understand what it's doing, what it's not doing.
Okay. Yep, sure. Let's have nonpartisan staff do that. Okay. Mr. Hopkins?
Sure. Madam Chair and members, so this amends a section of the open meetings law, and it provides that a public body may use social media to live broadcast a meeting subject to this chapter. So under the open meeting law currently, a public body is authorized to use interactive technology to conduct an open meeting. So this clarifies that a social media platform could be used under those existing statutes to live broadcast the public meeting as an interactive technology. It doesn't override those other requirements currently in law regarding the use of interactive technologies. It provides some clarification about what the comment feature in a social media platform, how that functions in terms of the public meeting. It provides that they're not considered government records. If public comments are accepted via the social media platform, they're not considered government records under the Official Records Act. And it also provides that all the notice requirements in 13D regarding the open meeting still apply if the meeting is live broadcast.
Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. I appreciate that. And Madam Chair, where is this bill going?
This is going to elections and GovOps.
Okay,
yep, that's the purview of open meeting. So.
Great, thank you.
Any other member questions? Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Gordon. I guess I have a follow-up question maybe for Mr.
Sure.
Hopkins or if anyone knows, but in my time as a public official, I have been occasionally criticized for deleting comments or not allowing comments on social media. And I'm just wondering if we have an understanding of the current law around public officials and deleting or not allowing comments.
That's a very good question. Mr. Hopkins?
Madam Chair, Representative Finke, we don't have a statute about that, no.
Representative Finke.
Okay, yeah. I appreciate this. Obviously, we want to use, I don't know. I'm always a little bit like, will we move meetings just into social media because we can do this and then turn off the comments and then we're just talking to ourselves without public participation? I don't know. Maybe that'll happen as a downstream effect. I want people to have access. That is obviously the point. But I also don't know what we'll end up doing.
Thank you, Representative Finke, for bringing that issue. And I've had some discussions with the bill's author about if the comments are turned on, to me, that is creating a public record or that is creating government data. So if you're going to turn those comments on, then that's kind of my, in keeping with current law, I just feel like that should be part of the equation. And I know I've talked to the bill's author and he's agreed to look at that with some other folks, some other stakeholders, and so I feel comfortable passing it out today, knowing that that issue is going to be addressed because the law is not clear. So it's a good catch. Any other questions or concerns? Yes, Representative Feist.
I just wanted to second what you just said. I agree that that's an issue that we want to address as the bill moves forward. Thanks.
Thank you. Very good. Representative Gordon, any final closing comments?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Scott, and thank you guys for the discussion and the feedback. And I will continue to look into that. And I will say that it's tricky, right? Because the comments portion of this, on one hand, you want the comments for more engagement and participation, but on the other hand, people are going to say more vulgar things in social media comments that they may not say in a public meeting, right? So I think, in my opinion, letting the cities kind of handle that on a case-by-case basis, whichever works best for their city, is what we're trying to do. And Chair Liebling, to your point, it is confusing because we're trying to offer, flexibility and really precise guidance on how this needs to be done. And so I really appreciate you guys letting me come in and speak with you guys today and appreciate the feedback. And we'll continue to work on this, and hopefully we can get it done. So.
Sounds good. Thank you. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3295 be re-referred to the Committee on Elections, Finance, and Government Operations. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. You're on your way. Thank you, Representative Gordon.
Thank you, guys.
All right. Our next bill on the agenda today, Representative McDonald, House File 2937. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Judiciary, esteemed members, and Madam Chair. Thank you very so much for giving our bill a hearing. I say our bill, even though my name's on it, my constituent and good friend from Delano brought this to my attention. I think it's always a very worthwhile when our constituents, our friends as well, bring something to our attention and say, hey, this is something that's broken and it needs fixing. And in this particular case, it has to do with family law and some of the family time when it comes to parental time with their children, something very important. And this deals with the parental consultants. So you have the bill in front of you and your talking points. I'm sure you've read some of the information. I'm just going to give a little introduction regarding this.
Representative McDonald, I'm going to interrupt you real quick, and I'm just going to move the bill before the committee. I'm going to move House File 2937 before this committee, and the reference or the referral would be just to lay it over today. So
very good.
Go
thank
ahead.
You.
Continue.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And actually, I do have a A1 amendment as well.
Tell us about the amendment.
The A1 amendment is to address a concern that was raised about the bill not having an effective date, kind of an important issue here in St. Paul, and the potential consequences of the state interfering with the right to contract. So the amendment is drafted that this will become law, if it when it becomes law, that is, of course, our goal. It applies to agreements of parenting, evaluating, signed, or renewed after August 1st of this year.
The
second section includes court decisions and evidence presented to the court on or after that date that I stated.
Okay. Thank you. Any member discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A1 to House File 2937, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Go ahead, Representative McDonald.
Thank you, members. Madam Chair, Minnesota state statutes currently recognizes parenting time expediators, but parenting consultants are not defined in state statute. Yet they are widely used in family court proceedings. These private actors sometimes influence parenting time disputes affecting fundamental parental rights. I want to be clear that the second section of the bill that you use in front of you today, section 2 of the bill, does not eliminate voluntary dispute resolutions. Parents will always remain free to seek help to resolve conflicts, and that's very important, of course. What it does is to restore a simple constitutional principle, and that is decisions affecting parenting rights must ultimately be made by the courtroom by a judge, not by a third party, private third party. This change ensures that parenting consultants may provide guidance to the parties that choose to hire them, but their determinations cannot become binding or serve as admissible evidence influencing court decisions. In short, this section protects due process, judicial authority, and most importantly, parental rights, while preserving voluntary dispute resolutions. Parenting consultants is fairly new in the state. It is also fairly expensive in the state. So this bill, should we decide to pass it, which I hope that we will, I understand Madam Chair is going to be laid over, but we urge you to support this and hopefully get it in passing. I do have a testifier from my hometown who brought this to my attention. He's become a good friend and has some testimony to present to you as well.
Perfect. Thank you, Representative McDonald. Go ahead to the testifier, introduce yourself, and continue on with your testimony.
Please. Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Sarah Briscoe. Members, House File 2937 addresses a structural problem that developed in Minnesota family law. Parenting consultants operate widely in the courts today, yet they're not created or governed by statute. Their authority largely comes from private agreements inserted by divorce decrees. This creates an unusual situation where a private individual who is not a judge and not part of the judicial branch may influence disputes involving parenting time and family decision making. Parenting consultants often resolve disputes through informal methods such as private meetings, email communications, and informal exchanges outside the courtroom. the processes occur without the procedural protections that exist in a court proceeding. Because parenting consultants are not statutory roles, the qualifications vary and authorities vary. Oversight is inconsistent. In addition, parents are typically required to pay consultants private hourly fees, which can total thousands of dollars each year. This places significant financial strain on families and can create inequities when one parent cannot afford those costs. From my personal experience, the problems with the system became very real. The parenting consultant in our case claimed to have experience working with children with autism. In practice, the experience proved to be very limited. Parenting a child with special needs already carries significant stress. It often, one parent bears the majority of that responsibility. More and more families with children who have complex needs are entering the family court system. And those situations require deep understanding of those conditions. Certain developmental or neurological conditions require far more than minimal training or general academic familiarity. They require real-world experience because decisions affecting education, services, or parenting structures can have serious consequences for the child involved. In my family situation, that experience gap created a real and lasting implications. Over a 10-month period, the parenting consultant had one verbal conversation with me. All communications were to occur via email after I repeatedly had requested even a phone conversation. The consultant was expected to review important medical information related to my children, but failed to do so. The consultant was also expected to examine the school systems involved, particularly services available for children with special needs, but that detailed review never occurred. In another instance, the parenting consultant challenged my son's counselor, accusing the counselor of not being neutral simply because the counselor shared information the consultant did not agree with. There were also private email communications between the parenting consultant and my former spouse discussing unrelated personal matters, including medical issues and surgeries, asking my former spouse what he wanted for parenting time. That type of communication raises serious questions about neutrality and fairness. Through conversations with other families, I learned that similar concerns and issues with parenting consultants are very common. In my case, the situation became so problematic that my attorney actually recommended that I stop paying the parenting consultant simply to try and stop the ongoing decision-making process, that was negatively affecting my children. The consequences have been significant. My children have faced educational setbacks. One child has been placed in a school system that does not provide the level of academic stimulation or support that he needs. My older son was physically assaulted at school, and response to that incident was inadequate. He has experienced repeated bullying. These are not minor issues. These are the kinds of consequences that can arise when important decisions affecting children are made without sufficient oversight. Even when a custody evaluator in our case was instructed not to rely on information from the parenting consultant due to concerns about reliability of that information, those materials were still referenced. The result has been increased litigation, not less. Faulty or incomplete information has entered the court system and affected the fairness of the process. In my case, and in conversations with other families, parental rights have been affected without full due process protections. This raises serious constitutional and policy concerns involving due process protections, separation of powers, and the delegation of judicial authority to private actors. High conflict cases represent roughly 5 to 10% of custody cases, yet they account for a large share of the post-decree litigation. I am currently involved in one of those high conflict cases. Nothing in this bill prevents parents from seeking professional help resolving disputes. Consultants may still guide and assist families if both parties choose to use them. What this bill does clarify that their determinations cannot influence judicial rulings or replace courtroom decision making. That distinction protects both children and constitutional rights of parents. Other states have addressed these concerns. Pennsylvania, for example, adopted Pennsylvania Rule of Civil Procedure 1915.11-1, which allows parenting coordinators only to facilitate communications and make recommendations. They cannot bind decisions or influence court rulings. Minnesota already has a statutory rule designed to address parenting disputes. The Minnesota statute 518.1751, which is defined by law and subject to judicial review. Parenting consultants, by contrast, often interpret court orders, issue directives, determine compliance, and resolve disputes. When that occurs, they are performing functions that resemble judicial authority without the constitutional structure that governs judges. Under the 14th Amendment, a parent cannot lose functional rights without notice, hearing, a neutral judge, and the opportunity to present evidence. These protections exist for a reason. The Minnesota Court of Appeals has also acknowledged that parenting consultants, only through private agreements between parties, including Sharzinski versus Sharzinski, which means private individuals, may exercise authority affecting parenting rights without legislative authorization or inconsistent statewide standards. House File 2937 ensures that parenting consultants remain advisors, not decision makers, not quasi-judicial authorities. The amendment protects the integrity of our court system, preserves constitutional safeguards, and ensures the decisions affecting families are made where they belong, before a judge under the rule of law. The core constitutional question is simple. Should decisions affecting a parent's time with their child ever be determined outside the courtroom by a privately hired professional rather than a judge? Members, this amendment does not eliminate cooperation or voluntary dispute resolution. It simply restores a fundamental principle of our legal system. Decisions affecting parental rights must be made by the courts, not by private individuals outside the judicial process. The impacts are quite significant. They impact not only parents, but the most vulnerable, the children. To end the session, I actually have a card from my son, as we've been fighting for over 4 years in this court system because of these implications, where he spells out, please don't stop fighting for me. Don't stop fighting for me. Don't stop fighting for a new school, because they have been going through an absolute nightmare for 4 years. For these reasons, I urge you to support Section 2, or the House File, 2937.
Thank you very much, Ms. Briscoe, for being here and for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Go ahead, come to the table. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members, thank you very much for having me here, allowing me this time. My name is Molly K. Olson, and I'm a Minnesota citizen and resident of Legislative District 41A. I'm the founder of the Center for Parental Responsibility, an all-volunteer, unpaid citizen education and support group since the year 2000. We seek family law reform that will better protect the parent-child relationships for fit parents. I've also been a mediator, a divorce mediator, for over 15 years. Before that, I was actually a parenting time expediter. I am in support of this bill, HF 2937. I speak as an unpaid Minnesota citizen who has engaged with parents for 27 straight years, who have had bad experiences with family court, including all the processes and all the practitioners families are required or suggested to hire. I actually just yesterday created a wheel of all the different practitioners that a family can get caught up in the family court process. Each one of these, I haven't even counted them yet, I just did this yesterday, at least 22 or more different practitioners that parents can be assigned to engage in their process. Most people can't afford it. Most people shouldn't have to go through all this, actually, either, if the parental rights are being protected. Like the testifier previously said, it's refreshing for me to hear the word parental rights come up in hearings like this. I was bringing up parental rights issues 27 years ago, as I've as I fight for the legislation that I've been working on for 27 years. And parental rights have previously been considered a dirty word, practically. So it's refreshing to hear it really considered wholeheartedly in this hearing. Parenting consultants have been a problem ever since they started. The evolution of all of these different practitioners that get involved have, from my perspective, mostly been added along the way, all these different practitioners that can get involved by what I call the divorce industry. If one thing doesn't work, they try another. If one thing doesn't work, they try another. If one thing doesn't, they create these positions a lot of times. And they're many of them are forced on parents, and some of them are voluntary. The parenting consultant positions are often voluntary, but what lawyers often tell these parents is that, oh, you're high conflict, and they write people off as high conflict. And not everybody is really high conflict that they say is high conflict. It's an easy way to start adding all of these different practitioners into the case if they call you a high conflict case. But some of them truly are high conflict cases. But this is not a men versus women issue. It's not a mom versus dad issue who have problems with parenting consultants. Everybody does. The parenting consultants are subject to their own biases, and they are allowed to get with all of their biases all along the way. And as the previous testifier said, there's really unlimited discretion and complete flexibility for them to demand whatever they want to demand of parents. They end up signing contracts. You know, for a long time, they were signing contracts that would be forever. So, I mean, you might be locked into this a parenting consultant and the same parenting consultant for, if your kid is, you know, depending on the age of your kids, it could be 15 years that you're stuck with this. And then they end up handling absolutely every little argument that the parents might have instead of teaching them how to work through conflict themselves. As a mediator, I'm really big on that. They start engaging themselves, and some of these parenting consultants are getting involved in just minuscule little fights and arguments all along the way, and of course they have to charge for that. And it becomes very overwhelming, and I also agree with the previous testifier that the PCs are under no obligation to follow the U.S. Supreme Court law of the land, which states that parents have a constitutionally protected fundamental right to the parent-child relationship, except if there's clear and convincing evidence of harm to the child. You can see Troxell v. Granville from the year 2000 as a case, and there's been over 50 years of cases that support that same concept. PCs really don't have to follow any legal standards of evidence either. And then when parents go to court to argue the PC decision, a lot of times the judges will go with the PC because they know the family the best, even though the PC wasn't required to follow any standard of evidence, any real legal standard of evidence at all. So it becomes a really vicious cycle on how these decisions are made. And a lot of times these parenting consultants will start to require, I mean, a lot of times parents start with a parenting consultant and they get a laundry list of all these things. We want this record from the school, these 12 records from the schools, and we want these 12 records from, you know, every therapist you've ever seen in your whole life, and we want the records of, you know, every speeding ticket you've ever gotten, and just everything. It's overwhelming what they have access to, and there's no limit to what they have access to. And if a parent says, hey, wait a minute, you know, maybe that's not your business, maybe this doesn't relate to the case, then the parent is often sabotaged, and all subsequent decisions end up being against that parent who wouldn't cooperate, was considered uncooperative because they wouldn't do everything they requested. So anyway, I'm just going to summarize by saying this is the short list of the problems with parenting consultants, and they really do need way more regulations. And while I think this bill maybe doesn't solve all the problems, I do agree that it is a very good start. So I would ask you to vote in favor of this bill, and I'm open to any questions. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? All right. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Olson. We will now move to member questions. Chair Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the testifier for being here today. We do appreciate it. I have a couple of maybe just technical questions, and the first one is, has a fiscal note been requested?
Representative McDonald, do you know, has a fiscal note been requested for this bill?
There has not been a fiscal note requested.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, yeah, if I may, I think one should be requested just because if more cases end up in district court, I'd be curious to know if the judicial branch thinks there would be a fiscal impact on them. So it would be really helpful if you would request a fiscal note. And then my other question has to do with how qualifications are determined. And I believe it's through court rules. And if somebody, maybe nonpartisan, can describe that process, I think that would be helpful.
Sure. Ms. Davis, thank you.
Chair and members, currently for a parenting consultant, the only rules that govern them would be the court rules, so Rule 114, but other neutrals, in this case, like a parenting time expediter, that is in statute.
Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's my understanding that Rule 114 has had some updates in 2023 in recent years. I don't know. I can't tell by your. I was just quickly looking at it, but
Ms. Davis,
Chair and members, I can take a look and get back to you.
Great. Thank you. That's all I have. Thanks.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it was 2022 or 2023 when those were updated. Yep. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative McDonald, for bringing this bill. It's an issue that I and I'm sure everyone around the table cares deeply about. It's my understanding, Chair Scott and Chair Liebling, that each of you in years past have spent a lot of time working on parental custody issues, and I have no doubt that that work was rigorous and done in good faith and produced good results that have made families stronger here in Minnesota. In spite of that, we continue to hear stories like the one we heard from the testifier today about issues in when it comes to parental custody and the way that the courts are handling that, the way that we are handling that here in this body. And it is clear that the work needs to continue. So thank you, Representative McDonald, for bringing that. What I will say, just to kind of set the tone, is it occurs to me as I hear these types of stories, you know, as a parent myself, who fortunately has not had to go through this type of a conflict, I have to imagine most parents would rather be incarcerated or deal with any number of tortures than to be denied time with their kids. And yet our standard of evidence for depriving somebody of time with their children is so significantly lower than that which we require for incarceration. I think that's a true inequity, a true disparity that needs to be aggressively addressed. This doesn't solve that problem, but it does go a long way. So again, thank you, Representative McDonald, for bringing it, and I look forward to supporting it.
Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative McDonald, for bringing this forward today, and appreciate your testimony. I just had a couple questions. You know, what's the number of, do we have any idea of how many parent consultants are out in Minnesota? You know, what is the number of people doing this line of work? And then my other question is, you know, obviously I understand parents will have conflicts with individuals you know, about all kinds of things. And you noted about having difficulties with, you know, I'm sure there's, when these consultants are making rulings and making judgments, you know, how does a parent break a contract if there is an issue? Is that a problem? And those are my two questions.
Representative McDonald.
Madam Chair, I'll have my testifier, Ms. Briscoe, answer that. She has some stories on that, or at least some things to share.
All right. Go ahead, Ms. Briscoe.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
To answer your questions, I'm not sure how many parenting consultants there are in Minnesota, unfortunately. As far as the ability to break the contract, it is next to impossible. The contract, I will share my story, and I've heard that from others as well, other families that have had to deal with the parenting consultants. So in our case, it was a two-year contract, and unless she voluntarily withdrew or we could go to the court systems to ask for relief to remove that parenting consultant, which took months and months and months to try and get on the docket, there was no way out of it, and that parenting consultant still had the opportunity to continue to make decisions. In my case, she eventually did voluntarily withdraw, but made a load of decisions that were extremely detrimental right before handing that voluntarily withdrawal.
Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you. And then how does that consultant charge? I mean, do they charge, you know, by the 15-minute time, or is it half hour, hour, day? Can you, and is that a kind of all across the board for, you know, is there a consistent fee that consultants charge?
Ms. Briscoe.
The payments were, if you sent an email, that was charged. And if my ex wanted to bring up an issue, then you're both charged because it's split down the middle. So you're charged for literally any time you engage with that individual, you are charged, very similar to an attorney. In addition, not only are you charged for that, you're charged for reviewing records. You are charged for the actual decision, quite hefty charge on that. In our case, it was $250 just for a decision. That's not counting the thousands of dollars before on emails or a review of some of the documentation. Unfortunately, you know, even if I did not bring up and I didn't have an issue, I was still charged and expected to pay half of it. So my ex could bring up a list of 10 different items, and I'm still charged for that as well on both sides. So, and as far as there being similar payment structures across, I'm not aware of that, but it is, you can rack up a bill very quickly, thousands per month easily.
Thank you.
One last comment.
Go ahead.
It seems like you get on the wrong side of your consultant, you're going to have some issues. So
absolutely.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Representative Donald?
Madam Chair, yeah, just to recap that real quickly, my research has indicated around $300 an hour is average. So should a parent consultant handle a suggestion to the parents, and they disagree with it, they have to petition the judge. So that could go out 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 months. And in that interim, the parenting consultant is still working, charging that amount per the case that they're working on. And then once, if they do get a judge, a court date, then the judge will have to issue another court date to issue another parental consultant to that family. So it's a vicious circle. If you imagine the proverbial hamster on the wheel, that is what's happening to parents who are stuck in a parental consultant that is not really benefiting the parents, but more importantly, the children.
And my understanding is many times there's a retainer too, a $4,000 retainer or whatever it is up front. I can't read your writing. Chair Liebling.
Thanks, Tina. That works pretty well.
No,
it's easy to read.
I couldn't hear.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. And no, thank you for bringing this bill, Representative McDonald. This is not an area I've ever practiced in. I'm a lawyer, but I've never been a family lawyer, and have often thought, boy, what a difficult profession, right? But I have been around the legislature a while, and we've dealt with a lot of these issues over time. Not this parenting consultant thing. I have to say, I really didn't know much about this, so I appreciate bringing the bill just to sort of start us thinking about this function and whether it's playing the right role. But I just asked to speak to kind of bring us back into focus a little bit. These issues, and just by the way, I'm a child of divorce myself, and it was a very, very bitter, ugly, ongoing situation that lasted for many years. So, and of course, the law was very different then. But I think we need to bring the focus back on the children. And our laws, we have been around this block a lot, Chair Scott and I, with these issues. And I think we have to remember that this is an area where, you know, every family with these, you know, terrible conflicts and issues, whoever's, you know, wherever fault may lie, if one can even talk about that in these situations, they're terrible situations. They're terrible often for the parents, but they're also, as the testifier noted, really awful for the children. We have in this committee and in this legislature, we have to make laws that apply fairly as much as we can across all the situations that may arise. And the problem I think that we have is that there's always somebody who comes in to tell us that things were not done right in my case and my, you know, these terrible injustices occurred. And those complaints to us, you know, are probably true. I mean, we from our role as a legislature have to try to design a system that works the best across all cases, and we can never get it right. We're never going to get it right. But I think something we did get right is we have so far, I think, kept the focus on the best interests of the child. It is, and surely, you know, I mean, Representative Hudson, you are right about, you know, these are some of the worst things you can think about as a parent, being separated from your child. I mean, most of us as parents would do anything for our children. And not only about being separated from them, but to try to, you know, if we knew something was going to harm our child, we would move heaven and earth to try to prevent that. But I think we just have to remember that as legislators, we are designing a system that has to work across the board the best it can. Sometimes that requires a little rebalancing. Maybe this is an area where some rebalancing is required, but we just have to remember that it is impossible for us sitting here in these rooms to determine the best interests of the children in every case. That job has to go to the courts, where they do look at each case, and maybe not always the best they should, and maybe the system, you know, the laws that underlie their decision-making have to be tweaked now and then. But we absolutely need to keep our focus on the best interests of the children. So, you know, I appreciate this. I appreciate the testifier coming in and telling us a story. I know it's very hard to do that, to share your personal issues with strangers, and really appreciate that. And I fully appreciate how emotional this is and how difficult it is. But I just want to remind the committee and the public that we are not sitting in a courtroom in front of and deciding an individual case. We have to try to make the best law we can that covers everyone. And by the way, since this issue has come up lately, we also don't enforce in the legislature, right? We are not an enforcement body. We set the basic laws about who enforces and how things are enforced, but we don't enforce when, you know, when judges make a decision that people disagree with, there's a process for that. And we don't, and this is not having to do with the testifier or with you, Representative McDonald, but we've been hearing from others about this issue about enforcement. So I just want to say on the record that we don't enforce here in the legislature, and I know you know that. But anyway, thank you for bringing the bill and having us think about this issue.
Yeah, first and foremost, Chair Liebling, please excuse me for not acknowledging you in the beginning as chair, co-chair. We're co-chairs in this legislature this year and last year. So thank you, Chair Liebling. And I couldn't agree with you more that we are not experts in everything and we can't solve every knee-jerk reaction. I think the parental control was something that the legislature, I don't even know if I voted for it, I've been here 16 years, so I'm not sure if it came to a vote. It certainly wasn't in the committees that I was in. But that was an issue, I think, that this legislature passed, I don't know what year. in attempt to really help parents that were struggling. And there are parental consultants, I'm not disparaging them, who are experts hopefully in their field that know family law, first and foremost, and keep the children, what's best for the children in mind always, and helping disputes. There probably was a very good reason why this legislature passed the law many years ago to allow parental consultants to resolve disputes like this. But it's come to a point where, you know, if there is a mistake by a parental consultant, because we're all human, we make mistakes, that is so difficult for parents to get out of that and so costly to request a judge. So, hey, you know what, this parental consultant is not really, we don't think, even if both parties, both parents think it's not best for the parents or for the children, that it's tough to get a different parental consultant, that they're stuck in this system. Very expensive and time-consuming to get another PC. So we did solve the issue, I think, Chair Liebling, probably this committee, the judiciary, and in goodwill to do great things to help the children and parents. But now this particular bill will help just a little bit more for those consultants that aren't either a good fit or something's wrong that's not really helping the children. And that would just be my answer on that. And I agree with you 100% with that statement, that we are not all... we can't answer every question and every pass every law to fix every problem. And sometimes when we pass a law, it makes another problem. And that's kind of the PC, the parental consultant. It fixed a very important issue, but now there's just a little glitch that we need to fix.
Thank you, Chair. And just to be put a little specific point from my perspective on Chair Liebling's points, I certainly appreciate the need for clarity around all of this. Anyone who's been even close to a difficult custody case knows how exhausting this is for everybody involved. And it's not just a one and done while you're going through a court case, right? Like this can be ongoing until kids are out of the house in some cases. One concern that sticks out to me when we're looking at the best interest of children, I do like on lines 1.18 and the next line where the court could discharge a consultant if the court finds that consultant is not serving in the best interest of the child. Yeah. I'm a fan of language like that because it is focused on the kids in these cases. What worries me about the bill as written is essentially the two lines under subdivision 8 is that any evidence or evaluations or recommendations made by that consultant could not be admissible in court. I think there are a lot of cases where some of those evaluations or recommendations would be quite helpful to a court when determining who's acting in the best interest of that child. So, just from my perspective there, I think that there is a lot of value that could come from some of those evaluations and experiences. That's kind of the major concern there that, you know, if we're moving forward, that I would like some a little more work on. But thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Curran. Very good points. And I think if the committee would be so willing maybe to hear briefly from Ms. Briscoe regarding that last line 2.7 to 2.8. I think it's a good question. And you're right, when a PC comes down with some good advice that you'd want the court to adhere to that or at least take into consideration before administering their decision. So, Ms. Briscoe?
Sure. Thank you. In regards to that, part of what the experience was, I don't disagree that evaluations can be very beneficial. Some of the challenge kind of articulated by the other individual who is here with us previously, is who is ordering the evaluations. Many of, from my experience, for example, I had to do certain things. I had to go find this person, or I had to go find this evaluation, and I could only use certain people that PC said that I had to use. But again, if you are already on the outs with that PC, those are individuals that she has direct contact with, or she or he has direct contact with. So I don't disagree that evaluations I think to kind of keep in where they can have you do anything, it's extremely expensive. It's very similar to just having a separate court litigation going on with a PC as far as financials are concerned, just by everything that can be ordered up and that you have to try and find funding for. It's very financially straining. So that would be my one cautionary as to maybe what they do order and how that's being performed.
Representative Curran, a follow-up, or you want to hear from Representative McDonald?
It looks like Representative McDonald
right
there. Yes, sometimes the light bulb goes off when you read another part of the language of the law. House fiscal research could probably verify this as well, but I think in the language, saying must, you know, must and shalls are big words here at the legislature, but I think what's important in that language is that the court, the judge, has an opportunity that he, in other words, if we didn't have this in, the judge must use all the evidence and evaluations and recommendations by the parental consultant, must. I think it's important that we give the judge the leeway to determine whether or not to use the recommendations or the evaluations or the advice. But when you tell in law that a judge must use what the parental consultant says, that ties the hands of a judge. And I don't think that's probably a good idea. But I'm not a lawyer or a judge, so.
Thank you. Thank you for the discussion today. And Representative Hudson? Quickly, and then we're going to move on.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me a follow-up comment. I just want to enter into the discussion based on the direction that it's gone, that I think the unaddressed premise under all this conversation is who is best suited to make the determination of what is in the best interest of the child. And it feels like there's a dispute that we're not addressing over the answer to that question. The premise that I would bring to bear is that there is nobody more qualified to determine the best interest of a child than their parent. It's unfortunate that we have these circumstances where parents end up disagreeing about what that best interest is, but the idea that the existence of that disagreement entitles any third party to come in and take over that parental responsibility, I think, is the fundamental flaw in how we've approached family law. Certainly in this state. So I just wanted to put that on the record. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you again for the discussion. And any final closing words, Representative McDonald? I know I think that the judge should have some discretion in this. There's some other areas of the bill that I think could use some work, but I do think that what one parenting consultant says becoming the law or the final decision maker for that judge, I don't think that's necessarily a good thing. So any final words on your part?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Co-Chair Liebling. Just the final word, would the old saying, mother knows best. No disparaging us men and fathers, because we're pretty good too, but the moms really kind of know what's best for their children, especially when it comes to their education and their health and well-being. And this bill would address that, I think. And in this case, and I'll close real quickly, as Ms. Briscoe pointed out, she knew what was best for her children with autism, and she wanted to move them from this school to that school because this school over here had much more programs to deal with autism. And the father said, no, we'll keep them right here in this school. At this point, mothers know best, and they were denied that because a parental consultant wouldn't have it.
Well, thank you, Representative McDonald. With that, House File 2937 is laid over. Thank you so much for
being here. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you.
Our final bill of the day is House File 3540. Welcome to the table, Representative Bliss. Well, We'll wait for everybody to get set up there, and then Representative Les will have you move your bill. And the motion is to lay the bill over today. So, Representative Bliss, would you like to move House File 3540?
Yes, ma'am. That is
my All right. House File 3540 is before us. Would you like to take up, I think there's an amendment, the A3 it looks like. Would you like to take that up now or?
Yes.
Okay.
Sure.
Representative Bliss moves House File, or the A3 to House File 3540. So the amendment is before us. Tell us about the amendment.
This amendment describes more of, in the original bill, it just said veteran of the military, and this opens it up, it clarifies it a little bit. We wanted to make sure that that the right people were being covered under this law.
Okay, thank you. And I do have a question. I know you have the National Guard here. Are the reserves part of that too?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. Or a former reservist, or okay, it is in there. Thank you. It just wasn't capitalized like some of the other things. Okay, the bill is before us. Please proceed with your. Oh, I'm sorry. We need to adopt the amendment. Any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A3, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. House File 3540, as amended, is before us. Go ahead, Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, there's a few people in this room old enough to remember the Vietnam War. I'm one of them. And the way our veterans were treated when they came home. That's changed considerably, and it really caught me off guard when I received a few phone calls last year, but from two different veterans, different parts of the state, not my constituents, and they were describing some issues. One was with work and one was with housing, and they were being discriminated against solely due to their veteran status. I found that hard to believe, but, you know, it's happening, and I asked them if they'd contacted the Minnesota Civil Rights Department. They said they did, and that veteran status was not covered under that. So I thought that it was important enough to protect our veterans from that kind of discrimination, so I want to add it to the Minnesota Veteran Rights or Minnesota Human Rights Act.
All right.
And I do have a couple of testifiers.
Okay. The first person I have on my list is John Kelly, the Director of Government Affairs. Please introduce yourself for the tape and your title and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members. For the record, John Kelly, Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning on House File 3540. If this bill was passed into law, Minnesota would join five other states that have added veteran status or military status as a protected class under their state-level non-discrimination statutes. So California, Massachusetts, Ohio, Virginia, and Washington have all passed similar laws. Additionally, Minnesota State added veteran status to their policy 1B, Equal Opportunity and Non-Discrimination in Employment and Education policy in June of 2022. This update to the Minnesota Human Rights Act furthers the interest of veterans and provides them with additional protection under state law. This is a great addition to the existing ecosystem of support for veterans and those still currently serving. We encourage support.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Slade, please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Nicholas Slade. I'm the Deputy General Counsel for the Minnesota Department of Military Affairs, the National Guard. We do appreciate that you have passed or adopted Amendment A3. It is critical to us because, to your point about reservists, it also does apply to them, but due to the federal nature of the reserve versus our status as state militia, we generally, unless we spend enough time on federal duty, we do not qualify as veterans under both the federal law and generally under Minnesota state law because it adopts the federal system. So, for instance, the recent call-up for the civil unrest or even the past civil unrest call-ups where the Guard has been called up and spent significant time on active duty, none of that qualifies us for federal veteran status because it was all state duty. And so it is important to add that former into the definition because as state forces, you know, we're here serving the state the state needs to be taking care of us. With that, I did want to address one other issue that we, that again turns on this problem of we're not necessarily, when we're at, when we are on state active duty, we're not necessarily recognized under a lot of the federal protections. And most significantly, the one of the problems that we've been regularly having has to do with education protections. And our, the reoccurring problem that we see is for Guard members who are involved in certification programs that usually, and it tends to be peace officers, EMTs, nurses who are working on a certificate program that is like a two-year program. And their courses, because of the way the course is set up, each course, each class builds on the next. And so if when we call them to active duty, and they start missing classes, if they miss too much of that class, they have to drop out. And because the class is only offered once a year, they may have to essentially drop out of school until that following year. And so, and again, part of the problem is because we aren't, when we are called into state active duty, we aren't triggering all these federal protections. The federal educational protections have actually a higher standard than the state educational protections, in that while the state 192.502 does provide that if a Guard member is called active duty, they can ask to be allowed to continue in the course, but it puts all the burden on the Guard member to try and stay current or catch up. And as opposed to the federal law places some burden on the school to assist that member to get caught up unless the school says it's an undue hardship on them. And so we would ask that the various members please look at this issue for us, because it is a significant issue. It rises almost every time we bring people on to active duty for any kind of length of time. It even comes up occasionally with when we have people drilling for our summer ATs. And so it's a significant problem that, and as the legal advisor for the Guard, I regularly providing legal advice and legal assistance to Guard members. So I regularly run into this problem, and it is a significant problem. We try and work with the schools, but oftentimes we end up having to release the Guard member from duty. So we are giving up our need to protect our soldiers, and we need your help. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Okay. We will move to member questions. Are there member questions? Okay. Chair Bliss, I'm just wondering, we've heard about the education piece of this. Can you kind of give us, you said there were examples in housing and employment, I think. Can you just kind of anecdotally share what happened in those cases that you're aware of?
Yeah. Well, the one with the employment, the member called me and stated that he was being reassigned because the other folks that he was working with didn't appreciate his military. When you're in the military, you tend to have a little bit different stature, different way of interacting with people. And because he was a veteran, they felt that he wasn't working well with his other members, and that's what they told him was because of his military attitude. The other one was in housing, where the person said they didn't want to rent to a veteran.
Okay. That's pretty black and white.
It's hard to believe that that stuff is happening out there.
Okay. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to speak to the question of what types of classifications should be protected, because I know that's a question that sometimes people ask is, well, you know, are we trying to protect innate characteristics which being a veteran is an innate characteristic, it's something you choose to be, or are we, is what we're trying to get after broader than that? And I feel like it's broader than that. I mean, religion is a protected class, right? That's not an innate characteristic. You choose which religion you believe. And I think the broader principle in anti-discrimination law is you shouldn't be denied public accommodation because of what you are. And some of the things that we are innate, things that we were born as or born into. But there are other things that define what we are that are matters of choice. But either way, a lot of those characteristics shouldn't be relevant to whether or not you get to access housing or whether or not you get to access employment, whether or not you get to access education. And so I just wanted to state that and thank you for bringing this bill and enter that kind of philosophical principle into the record. Thank you. Thank
you. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree completely with Representative Hudson. I'm just curious about, as I understand it, there are existing protections and benefits that go beyond regular employment for people with veteran status in the state of Minnesota. So I'm just curious how, you know, obviously these are illegal acts of employment discrimination, but to my understanding, there is like laws that make hiring veterans a benefit to an organization or a company. So I'm just curious, like, how this weighs these things together.
I'll defer to
Chair
Mr. Bliss.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. So there are existing statutes in Minnesota law around veterans' preference in hiring. But what we're talking about here isn't necessarily in the hiring process. It's in the worker existing in their field. And so what Chair Bliss is talking about is there was issues between the veteran and their coworkers around how they presented themselves in the world. And that appeal, that if this law was to be passed, that is a kind of claim they could make to the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. If a veteran has issues around firing or hiring, they can come and do a veteran's preference claim into the Department of Veterans Affairs. So there are existing protections. This is, as I mentioned in my brief remarks, another layering on of protection.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have follow-up questions, but I'm not ready to ask them because I don't quite understand this. So I'm just going to pause there. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Chair Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks, Representative Bliss, for bringing this so we can have this important discussion. I hear you about the problems that our veterans are having or that our guard are having, people that need to go on active duty and are having these problems doing so, and I appreciate your bringing that to our attention. And it's been a long time since I've served on the Veterans Committee, but I do generally understand that Minnesota hasn't always been that friendly to veterans and that we need to continue to improve on that. And I've been glad to see us improving over the years that I've been here, and surely we have further to go. But I do have some concerns about the bill itself, and I wonder if this is really the best way to solve the problems that are being brought forward here and noticed here. Now, you know, this first time I've heard about someone saying they wouldn't rent to a veteran. I mean, that, I don't know, that's a tough one. I kind of do wonder, you know, I mean, that, let's just, you know, be clear. We all agree that people shouldn't be discriminated against. I mean, discrimination is bad when it's, you know, discrimination based on something that is kind of not really related to you as an individual person is a problem. And I do worry a little bit about adding this, though, to the Civil Rights Act because, you know, it's, I don't think there's another category here that deals with your employment. And I wonder if it opens up a bit of a slippery slope because, you know, if a police officer is denied an apartment because somebody says, I don't want to rent to a police officer, or a garbage collector, or a farmer or anybody, you know, that there could be somebody who says, I don't want to rent to a fill in the blank.
Legislator.
Probably. A legislator. That's right. You politicians, we don't want to rent to you. You just, you know, somebody might come and protest outside your home and we don't want to rent to you. So I just think it's certainly a thing to think about, but I worry that it opens up something that we maybe don't really want to open up and that there are better ways to solve the issues that are being brought forward. So I'd like us to think about those. I mean, the issue about folks not being able to losing their education because they have to be called away to active duty, and then, you know, that seems to me it's not so much a discrimination against them based on their status, but it's like any student who would be called away and wasn't able to complete the program, I think, would be treated the same. So I don't view that necessarily as maybe there's more that I'm not hearing here, but that sounds to me not so much a discrimination based on their status, but just something that needs to be worked out so that that problem doesn't occur. And, you know, I think, you know, we'd all love to try to help solve some of those problems in ways that work to make sure that they're not just getting their ticket punched to say they got their education when they weren't present or didn't complete important, you know, we don't want them to end up disadvantaged because they have a degree or something and then they didn't actually get the education either. So, you know, I think that's really important. And, you know, the thing about the military attitude, that seems to be more about an attitude, not, you know, it's an unfortunate that somebody connected that and said that was, I mean, that's just, you know, it's not good. I certainly am not condoning that. I'm just not sure it's a discrimination based on the fact that they're military or a veteran. So I think, and I do appreciate the bill. I appreciate that we're talking about this. We in no way want anyone to discriminate against our veterans, our active duty military. You know, they give a lot, and we really, I think as a body, we really appreciate them. We appreciate their service. We appreciate that, you know, they have needs that we, because of what we ask them to do for us, and we should try our best to meet those needs. I'm just not sure that this is the right way to do that, and I hope we can continue to work on ways to meet those needs. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Do any of the testifiers want to have any comments on what the discussion has been today? It's your opportunity.
Madam Chair, and to Mr. Chair Co-Chair Liebling, I hope I said that right. And I think you hit on one of the distinctions that is important about protecting, especially protecting Guard when it comes to education, is yes, when other people may need to leave for a medical reason or something, that is tied to them personally. For the Guard members, we are being called by the state to come and serve the state. It's, as you pointed out, you know, that it's a slightly different thing than a personal issue. And so it really, because the state is what is causing the problem, the state really needs to address it. And that would be my one point to that. Thank you.
Right. Thank you. Chair Bliss.
My closing is just, you know, I did have the constituents call me and it was clearly discrimination. The only place I knew to send them was the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, and they said they wouldn't help them because of that. We did give them some other resources. I don't know. I'm guilty. I didn't follow up, but I told them to contact me if they still needed any help, and they haven't. But this just seems like the right thing to do. Other states are doing it. They're finding that it's needed in other states. Would be the sixth, you said?
Be the sixth.
Sixth state to do it. I feel it's important, and I appreciate your consideration.
Thank you, Chair Bliss, and thank you for bringing this to our committee for this discussion. And I want you to know we are grateful for the service of all of our veterans. And we sit in these seats because of what they have done for us on our behalf. So with that, House File 3540, as amended, is laid over. And with that, members, we are – oh, you know what? We should probably – Chair Liebling and I met this morning, and we want to just put a placeholder on the 10:15 time slot for Wednesday the 25th during deadline week as another possible committee hearing. So just to have that in the back of your minds, maybe place a hold on your calendar for that if we do need to have an extra hearing. So with that, we are adjourned.